Welcome to the Man Up, Man Down podcast, presented by Volker Baluda and David Pawsey. We discuss the pressures and challenges faced by men approaching middle age that we're often too embarrassed to speak about with our friends. You can find us online at www.manupdown.com. Enjoy the show and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review.
Welcome to another episode of Man Up, Man Down. Today we welcome Glenn Beamson. Now, Glenn wears many hats, so there'll probably be some achievements and accolades that I miss out here. However, I and Volker know him as the chief technology sponsor at Welldoing, a platform that matches you with the right therapist or coach. But you'll probably know that name as they are our longtime supporters. So on one hand, Glenn has a lot of experience helping startups scale through technology. He's also worked in big tech. Unsurprisingly, he's also passionate about mental health and self-improvement and is a qualified executive coach himself. And as I was doing some research, also found some pictures online which appears to show him competing in the Desert Ultra, which seems to have become a bit of a prerequisite for guests on Man Up, Man Down recently. So lots to discuss, and as I say, probably lots that I've missed out there. So welcome, Glenn. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks very much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, well, welcome to the podcast. Another ultramarathon runner. No idea.
Would I call myself an ultramarathon runner? I took part in an ultramarathon, but I'm certainly no runner, I think.
So you've done one and ticked the box, or have you done several? Sorry, I jumped in there.
So basically, I'm a bit of a kind of magpie in a way. So I like trying loads of different things. I'm quite happy to be, you know, average at a lot of things and try as many things as I could. And years ago, like a lot of people, I thought, right, I'll try the London Marathon. And every time I trained, I got to about 12 kilometers and then got shin splints every time. And eventually I went to a podiatrist and they put me on the running machine, you know, and they put these little things on your knees and they watch you run. And she basically finished and said, yeah, you're not cut out to run. Your legs are just a wonky shape. I've got legs like I could sit on a horse and my ankles would meet. I've got very bandy legs. And she said, you're not cut out to run. You can't do a marathon. So I said, okay, fine. So I put that to one side, did lots of different sports. And then when I was in my mid-40s, I was sitting around a campfire in the middle of the desert, funny enough. You know, I was working out in the Middle East. And somebody had just completed the Marathon des Sables. I said, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. And they said, well, why don't you do it? I said, actually, if I'm going to run, why not do that? And then I'm just going to tick off, like, you know, at the time it was quoted as the toughest ultra in the world. I thought, I'll tick that off. And that's me done. So I signed up. It's a ballot. It came through saying, yep, you've got the place. So I thought, oh, okay, I better start training. And I actually went to see a running coach and I said, look, I'm thinking of doing this. What should I do? What's the training plan? He said, well, what's your normal marathon time? And I said, yeah, I've never done a marathon. He was like, okay, what's your normal half marathon time? Nope. Okay, well, what's your 10K pace? What's your race pace? Never done a 10K. 5K? Nope. He said, you've got no chance of finishing that. So at that point, I was like, right, I'm definitely doing this now and I'm definitely finishing it. So that was that.
So you're the sort of person that is motivated by people telling you what you can't do and proving them wrong then.
Yeah, I guess, I always think if you want to do something, like half of it is just keeping going, you know, when everyone else gives up, it's just keep going and, you know, put a plan in place and just, you know, follow that plan really. So I basically was lazy and I started training. So the race is in, I think, April, May, I think. And round about December, I was at a Christmas party and I thought, do you know what? I really need to start this training because in whatever it is, 20 weeks time, I'm going to be running a marathon a day for 5 days. And so January, I put this plan together and I could see by week four, I was meant to be running something like 20K or week five. And I was thinking, oh my God, you know, I'm never going to do that. But you just slowly do it. And it's weird. You go from, like, you get to the point where you're going out for a 20K run and the first 5K is just your warm-up. You know, your head's in a totally different space. And a lot of the ultras, you know, you walk a lot of them, especially in the desert, unless you're a really super fit athlete. You know, you kind of maybe might walk for a quarter of an hour, run for 45 minutes, walk for a quarter of an hour. But yeah, I recommend these things. I mean, it's like extreme camping with running in the middle of it. That's what it felt like. It's totally mental, more mental than physical.
Yeah, you've almost kind of described how simple it is, but also how difficult it is in the, you know, it is literally a case of putting one foot in front of the other. But as you say, I mean, like I've done a couple of ultras now.
All right, cool.
Not in the desert. Yeah. In the UK, some very different conditions. But I mean, I just remember like my friend, I'd started doing, I think, 10Ks, and I had a friend who'd started doing 10Ks, and then he'd done a half marathon. And he was like, oh, I'm doing this half marathon. Do you want to do it? And I was just kind of like, nah, not really. And then, it was sort of near where a lot of family live. And I was like, actually, yeah, I think I will sort of do that, and started training. And then I was like, actually, if I've got to that level of fitness, I'm never going to be that fit to then do a marathon. So I was I'll sign up for a marathon as well. And yeah, it is almost like, and so with my sort of ultras, I did the London to Brighton challenge, which I think it was 35 mile. I mean, you can do it all in one go, but I live at the, you say about extreme camping, there was like, you know, you could camp, but I actually live in the village where the half is. So I was like, right, well, I'll, you know, just split it over 2 days. But, you know, if someone sort of came up to me and said, oh, you know, you should do that, I'd be like, no way. But then, as you say, it's almost like incremental steps to building up to that level of fitness.
Yeah, and I think it's funny, like, you know, when I was doing it, it is a lot of middle-aged kind of people doing it. I think your body is a bit more ready to do the long, slow, and steady the more the older you get. It's almost because you've got the patience. I think if I wanted to do that when I was 20 and someone said, you're going to run for 4 hours, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. I'll go and run for half an hour and then I'm going to the pub, thanks. But, you know, when you get older, you've got more time to kind of do these things.
Well, but again, as well, though, is it almost like a mindset that we reach at that age of, you know, you sort of realize that actually it is more mental than physical?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about, actually, I was just listening to one of your last guests talking about, you know, midlife crisis, and obviously it crops up a lot in your podcast tonight. I kind of dispute almost that word, because I think sometimes I think it's midlife choice. And I think when you have, you know, if you say, well, someone suddenly bought a fast car, it's a midlife crisis, I'm like, well, maybe. Or maybe that's just now they're at that age where actually they've got the money that they can do it. They always wanted to do it, but they never had the money when they're younger. And they've decided, well, this is probably my last chance to do this and enjoy it, so I'm going to go for it. And I think maybe his ultras are a little bit like that as well. You've suddenly got the choice. You can afford the time to train. You can afford the cost of flying to wherever it is to go and do the training. It's not that I didn't feel at any point I was in like a crisis, like I must do this. You suddenly feel like you've got the choice to do it and change your life a little bit.
I never had a burning desire to run a marathon. But at the same time, I was like, I don't want to be in my 70s or 80s. Wishing that I'd done a marathon.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's sort of, I mean, like I sort of went through a period where I sort of have set myself a big old, well, you know, an endurance challenge each year. So, well, as the pandemic hit, I'd signed up for a 10 kilometer swim, and then suddenly, you know, the pools closed down, you know, all the open swimming like places shut down. And I was like, all right, I've chosen the wrong event this year when I've got all the time I want to run and cycle, but I've chosen to swim. But yeah, I mean, like I keep thinking, right, I need to sign up to another challenge because I've not done one for a couple of years. But then at the same time, I'm like, I've proved to myself that I can, you know, put my mind and body through that.
Yes, yeah.
So we're, you know, now I'm almost like, yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of in a stage of like, I want to do something like that again, but yeah, I'm not sure.
I think you need adventures, you know. So interestingly enough, my wife's similar age to me, and they're superb at catching up. You know, her and her girlfriends, they're really good. And whereas me and my kind of guy friends that I've known since I was, you know, whatever, 10, 15, 20 years old, we're terrible, you know, because someone's like, oh, I just can't make it. I've got stuck at work, or I've got to do this. And so a few years ago, I said to them, listen, when was the last time any of you had like an adventure? You know, we used to have them all the time when we were kids. You know, you go camping, or as you get older, you challenge yourself to do different things. And so we've got a thing now where we said, like, well, once a year, let's do an adventure, you know. So we're going to try and swim to the Isle of Wight, for example, you know, and then maybe it's the next year after that, we might go and do some challenge, like a running challenge somewhere or something else. But something where you've got a target, it's once a year, you dedicate yourself to make sure you take that time off. And there's no pressure. You don't have to even finish the race. It's, you know, and so I kind of think, otherwise, life just gets dull if you don't have adventures, you know, whether that's, you know, in your career or in your personal life or doing a sport. I think you have to do something. And again, that comes back to, that's not, you know, if people are doing these things in midlife, it's not a crisis. And it's just having adventures and doing things and keeping life interesting.
So let me try to get a word in. So we could talk about all these marathons I run and all these ultras I dreamed of.
They might be in your future, though, still. You never know.
It's not about me. To be honest, my motivation for my first marathon was, like, I always said when my wife did one, I'm like, if I start, I'm going to be addicted to it. I'm not going to start. And then she done one, and I'm like, shit, now I have to do one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I did. I ticked the box. But yeah, I don't know. Would I do more? I don't know. I mean, let's maybe go back to your latest point you made about, you know, the midlife, right? Because I think a lot of people get to midlife and there's a void, right? There's this space, you know, obviously mentally or could be physically in that sense as well, where you go like, shit, I'm not as fit as I used to be, right? So I want to go back to the gym, or I need, you know, I need something new to do. I need a challenge like a marathon. Because once of a sudden you have time, right? Kids are usually at an age they can look after themselves. You don't have to be around them all the time. So you can carve out these 15, 20K runs, right? Those half marathons you talked about, right? You can carve them out on a Saturday morning, right? I used to go for a run Saturday morning, 6 till 8, right? You did your 21K, done, right? Weekend done. It's. I think that life transition where you once of a sudden you find yourself with more time, maybe not as fit. I don't know if there's a stat for it, but there must be one. I need to Google it. I bet that middle-aged men are the people that buys most road bikes in the UK
I'd bet. Yes. Yeah.
It's like, it's a typical one, right? People get into cycling, everyone else is doing it, it's healthy. And you can do it with other people as well. So to your point, right? You have this adventure. And I love the idea of having an adventure once a year, because I think on one of the last Stack News we said, oh, we should do that every year, right?
Yeah.
That's about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, you can't be just having a day out, can you, and just do something and then go to a pub and sit down, have a chat and a beer, whatever you...
Yeah. Hello, it's Volker here. I hope you enjoy this episode. You might not realize that I have been coaching for almost a decade through both third parties and private clients. During that time, I have worked with brands such as General Electric, Imperial Brands, DHL and Pepsi. However, this year, I'm putting a big emphasis on growing my private coaching practice, improving lives of middle-aged men in leadership positions. So if you hit midlife transition point, and you might be a bit stuck, or looking to improve your work-life balance, your career, or productivity, you want to build a new habit, or you just want to become a better version of yourself, please hit me up. You can reach me on Volker@Obnatos, that's Volker@obnat.us, or LinkedIn, whatever is easiest. Thanks, and now back to the episode. Should we talk a little bit about what you're doing at Welldoing?
Yeah. So
much into sports.
Yeah. So I guess, like, going back to the whole kind of midlife thing. So I guess I started off in big tech, did a lot of kind of CTO, international CTO jobs. And it was actually quite a funny career. So it was never something that I intended to do. I started off, basically, I grew up in the Northeast. I come from a mining community, 1984, 85, of course, the miners' strike. Everyone's out of work. Then I come from the East Coast, Hartlepool, then the dockyards closed down. And you just see all these communities just crumble from really thriving communities to nothing. And I think I just thought, right, I don't want to ever be in a position where somebody can do that to me, you know, take my livelihood away and do something. So I did that kind of thing that we all tell our kids to do, you know, got my head down, worked hard at school and so on, and ended up doing a PhD in when they were building GPS, basically, and helping to
improve the orbits of GPS for climate change, looking at mean sea level rise, all that kind of thing. Then very randomly, I was in Canary Wharf working there when they were building Canary Wharf, because we were measuring how much Canary Wharf sinks using satellites the first time that you could do that. And I saw a whole load of guys going into a pub in suits, and it was raining. I was on a building site. And I thought, you know what? I'm on a building site here in the rain, and they're inside a pub. They're probably getting paid more than me. Maybe I'll see what they do. And so I went to this bank and I interviewed, and I finished this interview, and they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I have no idea. And they said, well, okay, you've been an engineer, you can go to technology. I said, okay, whatever that is, I'll go and do that. And so I moved into banking, into technology, but it was 97. And so it was just at the kind of start as the internet was starting to bubble up. I literally knew nothing. I mean, the first day I literally sat looking at this computer and couldn't even work out to turn the thing on. You know, somebody came to my desk, asked me for something. I said, I've got no idea. They turned on my computer, wrote something down and walked off. And that was my first day. I was like, okay. So of course, this was before Google or the rest of it. So I had to go and read books and books and books and books. And we were delivering a project. And I said, well, look, why don't we use this new thing called the internet? And everyone was like, okay, that's good. What, rather than putting floppy disks in each machine, I said, yeah, we can. You can log onto a browser and get this program. Fine. So we built this program. On the day we were meant to roll it out, this is to about 2,500 people, I realized nobody had an internet browser on their desktop. So I had to run out, send the team out to the local corner shop, buy a whole load of copies of Computer Shopper magazine. So on the front, they had a disc with Internet Explorer 1 on it. Then we went and we had to load up all the browsers, and then we delivered this project. Anyway, that started a whole kind of career in almost innovation. So I saw the whole .com boom, the rise of mobile apps, all the rest of it, and basically spent, you know, kind of went from career change to career change in the bank. Just really having the time of my life, you know, having fun. I was young. And then at some point, there was some politics going on. I didn't like it. So I said, that's it. I resigned. No. And I kind of left. Anyway, I went to an interview and this guy said to me, why did you leave? I said, well, there was a load of politics and I thought it was nonsense, so I left. And he said something that really kind of changed my life. He said, well, because you left, it means all of your team now have got to deal. It was basically a manager who was very much a bully. All of your team have to deal with that. He said, if you actually concentrated on your career and became senior yourself, then you set those boundaries. You can decide if there's bullies or not. You know, that's your call. I thought, yeah, he's absolutely bang on the money, you know, because people talk about company cultures, but that I contend there isn't really a company culture. There's a culture of management. And if the guy running the company is a bully, no matter what the culture is, that the company's culture says on the, you know, formally, that's what the culture will be. If the guy running the company is actually a decent, fair bloke, the culture will be that, you know. And so I went back into it and actually concentrated on my career and ended up being an international CIO, basically, for a bank, and then a CTO for a sovereign wealth fund. And at one point, so I was 46, I think, I was sitting in a meeting. And I just suddenly thought, what am I doing here? I've done what I wanted to. I was financially secure, which had always, like I say, worried me from my childhood, seeing my dad getting put out of work and everybody I knew getting put out of work. I thought, nobody can affect me in that way. And I thought, and I've achieved what I wanted to. I've ran some really large teams and built a culture that I thought was very kind of caring and kind, but at the same time, very, very professional. We got a lot of work done. But I kind of felt like, yeah, in my head, I kind of almost ticked off what I was in this career for. So now I want to go and do something really, go back to the roots, go back to like coding, go back to working with startups and in things that have got social impact. So of course, you know, working in a bank, you know, there might be some positive social impact through, you know, the money then gets put into good cause or whatever. But I want to be right close to something that did social impact. And my feeling was two big things, conservation, because the outdoors is very kind of close to my heart. And what I really started my career in, you know, climate change, and mental health, because I think it's such a huge problem in the generations coming through. So I said, that's it. I'd like to work with a startup that works in social impact. And through pure chance, really, I was out mountain biking with a friend of mine in the village. They knew Julia. They introduced us, and I joined Welldoing as their CTO. And that was fantastic. And so I really enjoyed that, the whole startup piece. You know, it was really exciting to be you know, having done the big job where you obviously have to go to funding committees and management committees, and you're doing people's appraisals and end of year reviews and all of that kind of thing, to then move right down to tiny startups where you're the CTO, but you're also the chief fundraiser, you're also the cleaner, you're also the person doing all of the strategy. I really thrive on that. I love just doing lots of different things. It really keeps me interested. And so I spent kind of 5-6 years in the startup world, but over the last year or so, just had this creeping feeling that actually what I really underestimated that I missed was creating this culture in a team and a lot of mentoring that I used to do with a large team. I used to mentor a lot of managers. You can do some really kind of great stuff with young kids coming through, you know, and then it's great to watch their careers grow. So I started putting out some feelers, and through a chance, a role came up that was, again, another kind of big role. And it was at a very kind of entrepreneurial company with a lot of opportunity to change things and move things really quickly. So I said, okay, so at the tender age of 53, I'm back in big tech. And so with Welldoing, it's great because basically we have repositioned the platform. That's all in a great shape. You know, Julia and the team are doing some fantastic stuff there with the therapist. And I'm now taking a little bit of a step back, still looking at all of the technology, still looking after the strategy. You know, I'm not there full time, let's say, hands-on with the code.
Lots of interesting things in that, you know, that story. I mean, well, the things, I guess the two things I'd like to talk about, but stop me, Volker, if I go on for too long, is about company culture, but also, I guess, just sort of going back to what you were saying about, you know, the environment that you grew up in and, you know, the minds being closed down. So how old were you when that happened?
Yeah, 14, 15.
Right, okay. So yeah, what sort of impact, I mean, did you kind of recognize the impact that perhaps that had on your dad's mental health?
Well, so it's interesting. So it has an immediate impact because everybody was out of work. And, you know, my dad lost his job. So I can really remember clearly going home and opening the pantry door. And there was one of the first kind of supermarkets that did its own labels. It was called Fine Fare. And their own labeled stuff was bright yellow, like lemon yellow packaging, and would just have black or white big letters. So I'd open the pantry door and it would just all be yellow. It'd be like a box that just said cornflakes or jam or, you know, bread or something. And that was it. And, you know, dad had to sell his car. So, you know, at the time, actually, we were really good at badminton. Me and my brother, we both captained the county. I used to captain under 16s. He captained under 18s. They wanted us to go and play with the national team, but it was in Gateshead and we didn't have a car. So it says, no, we can't carry on that sport. And so kids that we used to beat then trained and then went on to the England team. And we had to say, no, we didn't have the money. So it had like an immediate impact. At the same time, it was really, and my mum and dad handled it in a really great way. You know, I mean, I remember them sitting down with us and they said, listen, we're really close to the wire paying the mortgage. So you and your brother, you need to take a job and we're just going to have to use the money, you know, for a little bit, you know, use the Christmas tips and so on. And neither of us had any problem with that because we're a close family and you just thought, yeah, I understand. You've explained that to me. I understand that. So we just go and do it. In the communities, it was, you know, Northeast really hasn't recovered from it, in my opinion. I mean, those mining communities were solid. I mean, it was so fascinating. You know, you saw the end of a way of life that almost hadn't changed since Victorian times. You know, even things like my granddad used to speak a dialect called Pitmatic, which was so broad, really, unless you were down the mines, you just couldn't understand it. It's and yet that kind of almost, you know, you get that really cohesive unit of men all working tightly together, and then the women at home making sure that they had clean clothes and food. It was a very traditional kind of way. Suddenly everybody's out of work, and as you can imagine, it only takes a matter of weeks for that to spiral into crime, you know, abuse, depression, all of those things, because you take away everyone's self-worth. So there's a lot of that. Having said that, in our family, my dad was a very pragmatic man, and he said, okay, fine, that's that. I always wanted to go to university. I'm going to go and do that. So he managed to get a grant, whatever it was, £2,000 a year, £3,000 a year or something. Me and him went out on building sites and did jobs for cash in hand. I was 15, so I used to go surveying with him and work on, like say, just working, laboring on building sites, basically. And we got by, and he did his degree, and he ended up being out of work for maybe 4 years or something, or 5 years, and then he, you know, managed to get a job, and you know, they went back, and by that time I got sponsored by the army. They paid for me to go to sixth form, and then I did sixth form and went off to university. So yeah, unfortunately my father passed away, because I would love at this age to talk to him about that, you know, because he was probably roughly my age now, I'm thinking, and how he handled that. You know, he had three kids, no money whatsoever, and it must have been super stressful, because there wasn't even a hope of getting a job, not for a long time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I guess that's the, you know, sort of the aspect that I was thinking of, that, you know, it's not only the only way of life that you've known, it's the only way of life that your father knew, your grandfather knew, you know, it's so embedded into
the... Oh yeah, all the way back, yes.
Yeah.
Man Up, Man Down is sponsored by Welldoing. As someone who has seen a counsellor for a number of years, I think their approach is great. They want you to find the mental health professional who is right for you. You can filter your search to highlight therapists with expertise where you need it, or you can pay to use their personalised matching service. The people who run Welldoing are experts in mental well-being, and they also have loads of posts and interviews to keep your mental health in good shape. Take a look at welldoing.org.
I mean, I'm going through a bit of a period at the moment where, you know, I'm reading more about AI and ChatGPT. And I was on an all-day course yesterday for ChatGPT. But, you know, I'm a copywriter and I can see what it can do. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm obsolete. And I've had to have a word with myself. It's like, well, you know, it's almost writing is part of me, but that's not where all my worth comes from. And, you know, it's sort of... I guess I'm a bit nervous about having to reskill and reinvent myself, but then, you know, compare that to a situation like that. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, there is going to be massive, you know, are we going to sort of see the same sort of job displacement as, you know, industrialization to then the full circle, as you say, of the mines being closed down?
Yeah. It's I think it's a long way to run, isn't it? I mean, interesting enough, when I did my climate research back in 97, if you talk to any scientists then about what was happening with the climate, you'd have a third say, it's fine, things will kind of cool down. You'd have a third saying, well, the graph's going to be roughly flat, and a third saying, no, it's exponentially up, no question. And then you rolled that on about 10 years after that, and of course, by then, there'd been a whole load of research and loads of new data and techniques and so on. And at that point, it was unequivocal, right? Like 99.999% of scientists said, there isn't a question. The earth is heating up and it's going to be exponential. And if we don't do something, it's going to be a problem. Now, of course, we roll on to now and we're all seeing that the outcome of that. I think AI is similar in that nobody can really call what's going to happen with it. And I think you could take a very pessimistic view and say, that's it. We're all going to, I don't know if you ever watched the film Wall-E.
Yeah.
Kind of kids cartoon thing. And basically all humans are just like big blobs sitting in chairs while all of the AI and all the robots do everything. And they're just all depressed sitting in chairs. You could take like a pessimistic view and say, well, you're coming on to like contentedness and self-worth. And if you haven't got something to do as a job or something to feel, to create and do and feel satisfied, then I think that's that's an issue, you know. But on the other hand, you might say, well, we harness AI and actually what it does, it just takes away a lot of tedious things, and we end up doing stuff that's more creative. It's a tough one though, because everybody isn't creative, and some people, you know, that there's always going to be a percentage of people who need to just do a steady job that could potentially be made more efficient, could be automated. And is it right to automate it? I feel like, you know, it's getting kind of, I guess, very cerebral, but I do think that you really want everybody to be employed doing something that they feel some self-worth at. That is more important than being hyper-efficient.
Oh, and the thing also, it's the value that it brings to society. I was speaking to one of the dads at my son's football club, and they'd, you know, unfortunately experienced some crime. And, you know, he's like, the police aren't interested. And I'm like, well, it's not the fact that they're not interested. They just don't have the resources. And, you know, and you're like, yeah, you know, are those, well, yeah, are those the sort of jobs that could be refilled?
Yeah, yeah. I do think it'll be an interesting thing because, you know, without getting political, it is something that I think political kind of sector, let's say, worldwide will have to grapple with as we go forward, that as we automate more things, more people worldwide will be potentially unemployed. And what is the solution, you know? How do you get those people feeling like they're living a fulfilling life? Otherwise, you know, you do get societal problems that knock on, you know. You go back to the Middle Ages and the whole, who are the guys that kind of went and broke the seed drill? Because, you know, basically it was making the whole agricultural revolution. It was putting them all out of a job, you know.
Really?
Seed drill. And you get that kind of thing. It might have been Jethro Tull. I'm not sure.
What, the band?
Yeah. Maybe he invented the seed drill. I can't remember now. Yeah, so I think that's it. And it comes back to, like, what is contentedness? So I worked in the Middle East, and I certainly saw, you know, they have huge problems with depression there because, you know, you suddenly have a lot of wealth in the country from the oil and so on. And if you can sit in front of a TV and buy anything that you want, it's you know, it's almost depressing, right? Because nothing has any worth if you haven't had to work to do it. There's something deep in our psyche, I think, that means if you work for it and someone says, well done, or you get something for that, it definitely ticks a box. We're hardwired, I think, to do something for society and get rewarded for it.
I mean, with AI, and so I always bring it back to therapy and coaching a bit. I think if you coach, like I do, and you do, I guess, a little bit as well, right? In therapy, right, you can't replace that with AI, can you? I mean, I know there are a couple of apps out there trying to give you reassurance, you know, via AI, but I don't think actual therapy can be replaced with computers.
I don't think so. And I think it's because we also have an inherent laziness. And so I think when you think about therapy, it falls, I think, there's a little bit of an overlap with things like sports coaches. And yeah, there's a difference saying, I'm going to go to the gym, and you go two or three times, and then you kind of, then you can't the next week because something else is open, you can't the week after, then you kind of give up and don't bother. And then your next year's New Year's resolution is, I actually need to go to the gym again because I didn't get fit last. And I think a little bit like that, if you have to see a physical therapist once a week, I think a massively important piece of that, aside from the therapy, is it's consistent, and you have a consistent reason for going. And interestingly enough, I do love, you know, working with people who've got really interesting ideas, interesting startups. And I saw somebody a couple of weeks ago, and they were using technology for phobias. So one of the ways that you do your therapy around phobias, so let's say you're scared of spiders, for example. You know, you might say, okay, so imagine you're in a field and there's a spider in the next field. What's your anxiety level? Okay, it's 1 out of 10. Okay, now that spider's in the field next to you. What is it? Okay, maybe it's 2 out of 10. Okay, now it's on your arm. All right, that's 9 out of 10. And of course, you're working with that client to try and bring that anxiety down so that when they visualize the spider on the arm, now it's 2 or 3 out of 10 and I can handle it. The problem is, if you're a very visual person, maybe that works for you. But if you're not, you eventually might come out of that therapy session saying, yeah, I could handle visualizing that spider on my arm and it was 2 or 3 out of 10. And then you, whatever, lift up a box from in your room and a spider runs out and you have a, you know, a huge panic attack because actually, you said that you'd got yourself visualized in that position, but you couldn't do it. So what this guy is doing is he's using an Oculus, you know, the virtual reality thing.
Yeah.
And basically they've used lots of computer generation, but also then the 360 degree camera technology these days. So the tarantula is a real tarantula. And when you're looking through Oculus, it is on your arm. And so you don't have to visualize it. It is bang on the money, looks exactly like a spider's on your arm. And so they're just starting some testing with that. And they took it one step further. So, well, let's do it so that you can just basically pay for this therapy. So you might send a subscription and we'll send you the Oculus through the post with all of the programs loaded up. And you just do that. The problem with that is that then they found that individuals were not consistent in doing it. And so the levels of, you know, positive therapeutic outcomes were not as much as if they said, actually, you're going to still do the exactly same thing, but you're going to do it physically in an office, whatever, 3 p.m. every yeah. Thursday. Because that forced you to go and do it consistently, and so you got through.
That's interesting, because I can see how it works with phobias, right? And I guess it's similar to having, you know, a pre-recorded hypnosis session, right? Which, you know, I'm sure relaxes you and everything else, but it's not tailor-made. You don't have the client relationship. You don't have the trust, right? So you can't go into the specifics. So it works to a certain extent. And I'm trying to look for an analogy here, but But I can see how that works, right? That you use virtual reality to, I don't know, look at spiders, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually go like, yeah, spiders, that's fine. You know, I saw them often enough.
I mean, I've brought it up. Well, I think I bring it up in pretty much every episode. But there was this TV series, Limitless, with Chris Hemsworth. And, you know, it was all about sort of longevity and, you know, how he can, just keep himself living longer. So, like, one of the, I think the first episode actually was kind of about anxiety and phobia and stress. So it was, you know, it was all around how can I overcome stress? And I'm sure they could have found an easier way to do this, but basically they had him, and I think he's scared of heights, I've forgotten the term. So basically he had to walk out on like this metal girder on top of this like really high building in Sydney, I think it was. But sort of in preparation for that, they put him in on a, you know, an Oculus on his head.
Yeah.
And, you know, they sort of showed what he was seeing, and it sort of showed his heart rate. And basically he was reacting physiologically as he would if he was really up on this thing. And obviously it was to build him up to a point where he was confident enough to like walk out. But yeah, you know, it is sort of interesting that, you know, we are getting, I mean, and Volker sort of talked about, you know, this sort of thing of us being sat at a boardroom table, you know, having a chat, but we're all, you know, in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
There is just so much going on in tech that's, you know, and you know, I've sort of said about AI and like, oh, you know, I'm worried about becoming obsolete, but, you know, the implications for it in, you know, making society better. And I mean, I have seen a lot of figures about, well, you know, these jobs will disappear, but there will be lots of new jobs created, and sort of, you know, the jobs that our kids will have, probably, you know, a lot of them haven't been invented yet.
Well, that's true. I mean, like I say, you know, right, my granddad, there he was as a coal miner. He died in 1970-71. And then I ended up working in technology, which didn't exist, you know, in a role called a CTO, which didn't exist, in Abu Dhabi, which didn't exist.
Yeah.
Never in his wildest dreams could he have ever, like, pictured where I'm. And I kind of think, God, yeah, I wonder what my grandkids will do. It's going to be something that just I can't even envisage, because it just doesn't even start to exist at the moment.
I mean, you know, like, I sort of, well, a conversation that me and Volker had recently was just around our sort of fears of, well, our teenagers, you know, our children getting older. And one of the things that we sort of talked about is, boy racers, you know, it's like, well, our kids might not necessarily be boy racers, but they might get in a car with someone. But then on the other hand, I'm like, well, will my son actually learn to drive? You know, but certainly my grandchildren probably won't learn to drive, because it will all be self-driving cars by then.
Yeah, and that's a case where I think, you know, technology will be great. I think the second that you have self-driving cars, you take all that stupidness out where you get in a car and you start road rage or think, oh, I'll just speed around this bit.
Yeah. And you stop worrying about your older parents, right, as well. So my dad still insists on driving over from Germany, and he's attend the age of 80, right? And I tell him why, you know, they're trains and everything else. But if it was self-driving, you don't have to worry about it. And you don't get these people driving 20 along a 60, you know, road. Like it's 6 o'clock in the morning. Seriously, I had one again this morning going to the gym, and it's just drives me potty.
My friends will tell me I'm a massive bore because of this. But I always say, what frustrates me is, if the speed limit is 70, why sell any cars in the country that can go over 70? Because then you've got to pay for police and pay for cameras. And that all comes out of our taxes that you could spend on schools and something else. I'm like,
it's because you want to take cars to Germany, you see.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Well, that's basically what they say. They say, Glenn, you're very dull. Be quiet. Okay, fine. But I think it's a valid point.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, with a, you know, if I look at my driveway, I mean, I used to have some midlife crisis car who went well above 70.
Yes.
Lovely, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was no point in this country, right? Yeah. you're driving it up to 70, maybe 75. I never went over that, of course.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't matter, right, what kind of car you have, because you get from A to B at 70.
Yeah, I quite like those new 20-mile-an-hour zones. It's like you've gone back in time and you can just have like a cup of tea while you're driving through a village.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
And to be honest, it's necessary as well, in my opinion. We don't have them here yet, but, you know, I can't see how people would drive any faster through the town, you know, especially when school is just out and there are about 1,000 kids walking up the...
We live out in the rural part of Oxfordshire, yeah. And they've brought it in there. The first time you do 20 miles an hour, you think, what speed is this? This is like 1 mile an hour, surely.
Yeah.
No, it's 20. Feels so slow. But after a while, you do really get used to it and it's relaxed. You're going to think, yeah, that's cool.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, this is kind of one of my, well, I don't know whether favourite topics, almost triggering topics, but...
yeah, don't give us that.
I mean, like, well, we have horrible, like, problems of traffic in our village, and I set up a dangerous driving action group at some
point. All right, excellent.
But, no way.
But, oh, man, no, if you Google Britain's most dangerous roundabout, and then, yeah, my face might pop up. We have like volunteers that do speed watch and you know, and only like this week there's people like complaining about the plastic police, and it just seems like the one law that people just think is, you know, guidance rather than law.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, I don't give a fuck if I'm going to run over your child as long as I'm not, you know, two minutes late to meet my mates at the pub or whatever, you know. It's have I never ever broken the speed limit? You know, I hold my hands up that, you know, I have done it, but
what do you have? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I would love to see the research though. I mean, what is it about driving that turns very polite kind of normal people into absolute nut jobs? It is something, I just don't understand what it is about suddenly locking yourself in that little metal box that makes some people go like that.
Anyway, we got up on a tangent.
Let's not get onto cyclists and getting stuck behind them and all the rest of it.
Oh, well, I'm a keen cyclist. Well, thanks, Glenn, for, you know, all your support over the last year or so of, well, I think by the time this goes out, probably will be like 2 years. But, but yeah, you know, thanks for all the support the World Doing's given us, and, you know, look forward to... hearing about your adventures that you've got coming up with your friends and with your work.
Well, kind of well done to you guys. I think it's such a huge thing. Of course, at World Doing, you know, we see this day in, day out, you know, people really struggling with lots of problems. And of course, the percentage of men that we see on the platform has just risen hugely. You know, in the last kind of 2 years, we see that going. It used to be kind of 70-30 women to men. Now that's the men are getting almost to the point where we see equality with women as men feel more comfortable through podcasts like this about talking about mental health. You know, with my own family, my son struggles with lots of things, and it gives a platform to talk about these kind of things. It's a lot more prevalent in the younger generations, the ability to talk about it because people are being more open. So I think it's fantastic. So. Well done to you. I'm more than happy to spend the hour chatting to you. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Feel free to reach out to Folker or David via our website, www.manupdown.com, or podcast@manupdown.com, with any feedback or to let us know what topics you'd like us to cover in the future. Hear you again soon.